This is the Morning Magazine for Thursday, April 29th. I'm your host, Shannon Young. Coming up on today's program, a look at how last year's massive wildfires led to a migratory bird die-off across the western United States. A local farm aims to regenerate the soil by keeping boulder compost in the area. And, care for a short story? There's a machine for that at a local bookstore. We then go to BBC headlines at the bottom of the hour. Then Dr. Chris Urbina will join us live for a COVID update. Urbina is medical officer for Boulder County Public Health. If you have a question for Dr. Urbina, you can email it to dj@kgnu.org. That's two letters, dj@kgnu.org for COVID questions to Dr. Chris Urbina. Then at 9 a.m., No Regrets Living, a new book offering ideas on how to better appreciate what we have in our lives. We'll talk with the author, Dr. Harley Rotbart. Our day of diverse music begins at 9:30 with the Morning Sound Alternative. But first, these news headlines with Sam Fuqua.
COVID-19 vaccinations will be required for all students, faculty, and staff at Colorado's major universities this fall. Wednesday's announcement of the vaccine mandate includes all University of Colorado campuses, as well as the entire Colorado State University system, Metro State University in Denver, and the University of Northern Colorado in Greeley. The Denver Post reports that the combined enrollment is more than 170,000 students. A growing number of colleges and universities across the U.S. are requiring COVID inoculations for fall semester. Fort Lewis College, the University of Denver, and Colorado College had all previously announced vaccine requirements. The new rule is designed to help restore in-person learning and on-campus activities. Colorado already mandates that college students be vaccinated against measles, mumps, and rubella, but exemptions can be made for medical or religious reasons. A CU spokesperson said exemptions will also be possible for the COVID vaccine requirement. Meanwhile, COVID cases among school-aged children are increasing, but a group of Denver-area school superintendents are asking the state to end quarantine requirements for students with possible COVID-19 exposure. Steve Miller reports.
With about a month left in the spring semester, 12 Denver-area school superintendents sent a letter asking the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment to discontinue the 7-day quarantines for the remainder of the spring semester. The Denver Post reports that the letter asked to end the quarantines because disruptions to in-person learning increases stress among students who have to switch between classroom and at-home learning models. According to the self-reported data, more than 3,000 students have been quarantined during the last 2 weeks, and their infection rate has been less than 0.2%. It's unclear if the districts required students in quarantine to be tested. Adams 12 did order the testing of 45 student-athletes in order to compete in regional and state competitions. All 45 tested negative. On Tuesday, health officials said the largest amount of transmission is between 11 to 18-year-olds. Anyone 16 years old and up is now eligible to receive the vaccine. Denver Public Schools and Boulder Valley Schools did not sign on to the letter, saying they wanted more time to discuss the idea with educators. I'm Steve Miller for KGNU.
Property values increased by as much as 20% over the past 2 years, according to a new report from the Boulder County Assessor's Office. The county reappraises over 130,000 properties every 2 years. The Daily Camera reports that values went up in every part of the county, but homes in the foothills west of Boulder saw the largest jump, with an average 20% increase. Gun Barrel property values increased 16%, while Boulder and Longmont increases were at 10 and 11%. The amount of property taxes owners will pay for the next 2 years is based on this latest round of appraisals. Property owners have until June 1st to appeal their valuations. A $400 million infrastructure package will be on the ballot this fall in Denver. Mayor Michael Hancock announced the proposal Wednesday. If approved by voters in November, Denver would sell $400 million in bonds to pay for a wide range of projects detailed in the city's 6-year capital improvement plan. Hancock says the plan will create thousands of jobs. Sunny skies today across the metro area with temperatures near 70 degrees. Clear overnight with lows in the 40s. Sunny and warmer tomorrow with highs on Friday in the upper 70s. It's 9 minutes after 8. This is KGNU.
You are listening to KGNU's Morning Magazine. A new study published in GeoHealth based on crowdsourced data from an app has found last year's wildfires may have played a larger role in the 2020 mass die-off of migratory birds across the western United States than previously thought. KGNU's Hannah Lee Myers has the story.
Migratory birds are making their presence known on the Front Range once again. As cheery as they sound, in reality, many of the bird populations that make their way through Colorado are recovering from a devastating 2020 migration that resulted in a mass die-off.
Do you think it was the breeze?
I have no idea.
Photos and videos like this one, taken by journalist Austin Fisher, started showing up on social media in the fall of 2020. Showing hundreds, if not thousands, of dead birds that seemed to have fallen from the sky, leaving experts and the public confused as to what happened. Inspired by these mass reports of avian deaths, experts like Annie Young, an infectious disease and health-focused ecologist working as a postdoc fellow at Colorado State University, with a joint position at the USDA APHIS Wildlife Service, started looking for answers. That's when Annie Young and her University of Wyoming colleague, Dai Young, discovered the iNaturalist app, where citizen scientists usually post information about living birds, had become a place where reports of avian deaths were being compiled.
During that time period, it has been found like there's hundreds of the die-offs that are recorded by the citizen scientists, and then that's a very unusual event, and that's kind of like the reason that the iNaturalist started this project here.
So what did you find when you started looking at the iNaturalist data?
What we've been found is that the wildfire and the toxic gas and the smoke, the fire produced will significantly impact the spatial distribution of the events being found.
Young is referencing the devastating 2020 wildfire season that burned over 10 million acres in the western United States and 625,000 acres in Colorado alone, including the three largest fires on record in Colorado history.
The toxic gas, the smoke will definitely impact their health because, like, the birds are really sensitive. Their respiratory systems are really sensitive to those air pollution, so...
Young's report is by no means the first to look at what caused the 2020 migratory bird die-off. At the end of 2020, the USGS National Wildlife Health Center posted the results of necropsies that found that 80% of specimens showed signs of starvation, and some reports were pinning the mass die-off in the West on long-term starvation made worse by unseasonably cold weather. However, at the same time, the Audubon Society was pointing to starvation, weather, and fires. Young says their new report linking the die-off in the West to the wildfires and toxic gases just adds another piece to the puzzle.
So the fire, the storm, and then the die-off events are happening at the same time. We were trying to figure out, like, what is the environmental factors that influence the those die-off events. So what we were trying to look at is, like, say, to look at this at a more, say, macro scale, more broad scale, or more focusing on, like, say, more trying to look at what is the factors that influence the spatial distribution of those observations on the landscape. So I think, like, we were kind of looking at them at two different scales. And another thing is that some of those factors could be related. For example, we know, like, the wildfire will cause, say, the direct death for the birds. And the second thing, it will cause the habitat loss for all the wildlife species, not only just the birds, but also some other species, and that's also, like, say they are lost in their habitat, they are lost in their homes, and they couldn't find the resources, then that could be one of the reasons that has been mentioned about in the early report from the USGS. So those factors are actually can be linked.
Young says some of the species most frequently recorded on the iNaturalist app as part of the die-off were the mountain bluebird, the western bluebird, and flycatchers. But it seems the greatest impact was felt by warbler varieties, like the Virginia warbler, the Wilson's warbler, the orange-crowned warbler, and the Townsend's warbler. Geese, hummingbirds, and sparrows were also part of the die-off. For some of these species, it's going to take a while to recover from the 2020 die-off. To make matters worse, climate change predictions and lingering drought across the West means we could have yet another rough year when it comes to wildfires, which Yang says could cause further decline in certain migratory species. So what can be done to help protect migratory birds? Yang says ensuring citizen scientists continue to monitor bird populations and report avian deaths on apps like iNaturalist is important. But considering the findings of this new report, strict adherence to fire regulations and safety seems important as well if we're going to ensure the same migratory bird populations continue to visit the West season after season. For KGNU, I'm Hanley Myers.
You can find out more about how to protect migratory birds by participating in Environment for the Americas World Migratory Bird Day next Friday, May 7th. More information on migratory birds and a robust catalog of bird sounds can also be found at audubon.org. You're listening to KGNU's Morning Magazine. The Boulder Bookstore on the Pearl Street Mall offers a variety of reading materials, but as KGNU's Maeve Conran reports, it's recently been offering something for readers looking for the quickest literary hit.
Just inside the front entrance of the bookstore stands a tall, futuristic-looking machine that invites you to select a read. As the bookstore's Stephanie Schindhelm explains, it's a short story dispenser.
It's pretty much exactly what it sounds like. It dispenses short stories. So we've got there are touchless buttons. So you just have to hover your finger over one of the buttons. There's one that'll give you short stories or poems for kids. One that'll give short stories or poems in Spanish, and one that does general sort of short stories for adults.
So let's see it in action. If you come over and you say, "Okay, I want a general short story,"
press the button. Yeah, you don't even have to press it. Just push your, you hover your finger over it, and then
out pops the story.
Out pops a story.
Called "We Caught Crawfish"
by Jennifer Van Keen. In the stream behind your house, we absconded with one. He pinched at my cupped palms as we bounded up the stairs into your room. We threw the door closed. We thought we set him free in your aquarium. And we slept that night, arms touching, bellies still sore from giggling. And we woke to a guppy-less aquarium. We carried him back in a bucket. We couldn't carry that weight with bare hands.
Very nice. So are there infinite numbers of stories in here? I mean, how does this even get programmed so that there's short stories for anybody who comes along and wants one?
I honestly don't know how they decided what was in here, but I've seen a lot of people come through and get one, and everyone I've seen, I haven't seen the same one twice. So it's not just one story or poem that's in here. It seems like you can kind of do it infinitely, and it prints out on this paper that looks very much like receipt paper, but it is recyclable, and it's printed, like the ink is heat based, so it's recyclable, but you can also keep it in your pocket and pass it on to a friend or someone you meet on the street.
And you can get them in Spanish as well. And how long is this short story dispenser going to be here at the Boulder Bookstore?
It's here for the month of April, so it'll be here right up until April 30th.
You can find the short story dispenser right by the Pearl Street Mall entrance of the Boulder Bookstore, but you have just until Friday evening to use it. If you don't make it by then, you can find another short story dispenser at the Boulder Public Library main branch. For KGNU, I'm Maeve Conran.
And congratulations to Maeve Conran for her most recent award. Maeve was part of a team of reporters that put together a fossil fuel reporting collaboration for the Rocky Mountain Community Radio Coalition. The series has won a second place award from the Society of Professional Journalists for public service in the small newsroom category.
Hi, this is Nick Forster. Join me this week as we celebrate 30 years of E-Town with the first part of our two-part series. This one will feature music from Sarah Jarosz, Los Lobos, Sam Bush, James Taylor, and more. That's this week in E-Town.
Sunday morning at 11 on KGNU.
Feel like dancing? KGNU's got you covered every Thursday night with classic big band and swing tunes, plus modern favorites sure to make you jump, jive, and wail. It's The Swing Shift, every Thursday from 9 to 10, here on KGNU.
Jack and Jill went up the hill to get a pail. Jack and Jill went up the hill to get a pail.
Most of the compost put into bins in Boulder County has to be shipped about 100 miles away to a processing facility. A local farm has launched an effort to keep some of the county's compost within its boundaries to regenerate soil and nurture trees. At the Yellow Barn Farm, Allen's Farm, a historically landmarked property just outside Boulder, a group of volunteers planted 3,500 trees in 3 days as part of an effort to rehabilitate the soil through regenerative permaculture. KGNU's Rosana Longo visited the farm during the planting event.
We want to put the tree in the hole, make sure the hole's deep enough. If it's not, you can move it out with your hands, or we'll grab a shovel if they're kind of not so great holes. We're going to put the tree in the hole, and then I like to take all the soil from this backside.
That is Nick Di Domenico Jr., co-executive director of Drylands Agroecology Research and regenerative farmer and designer, providing instructions in how to properly plant a tree to a bunch of volunteers. At the Yellow Barn Farm, we spoke with a young owner. Allen's Farm is a historically landmarked property just outside of downtown.
My name is Audrey Wyckoff. My family has owned the Allen's Farm / Yellow Barn Farm for the last 20 years. It was originally a horseback riding facility, and we are now converting it into a regenerative, sustainable farming community. We have been working with Drylands Agroecology Research, DAR, to really look at an entire regenerative design for this beautiful 100-acre property, really looking at how to implement silvopastures and intensive animal management in order to really bring the soil back to life. What we've really been learning over this course is that the easiest way to combat and actually reverse climate change is really regenerating the soil, because as the soil becomes healthier, it has the ability to pull carbon from the atmosphere and put it back into the soil to help bring trees to life. So this has been a massive endeavor, and we are currently out here for today, our carbon sequestration celebration. We've had over 200 people register for the event and come out to help us plant 3,500 trees this weekend, which is pretty fantastic. During this time, we are actually launching our compost initiative. So for fruit scrap pickup, we realized that we sent out a produce survey to all of Boulder County. About 200 people responded, and 50% of those people told us that they were currently not doing anything for food scrap or compost. So we're launching this program as a way to be able to reduce food waste. This is an awesome, valuable input for our pigs to consume as they are working through our market garden so we can actually plant more veggies. And it's also an amazing revenue stream that allows us to offset the cost of producing food for the community.
That point that you just mentioned about composting is extremely important, because we many times put things in the compost we know now doesn't go anywhere. So if you can speak about that issue and how really you are turning the page.
Yeah, I think that was the easiest point of entry for us to recognize that there was a massive outsource of these valuable inputs, this food waste that we are not really doing anything with right now, but it's something that farms really could use. Our hope for this composting initiative means that we can collect these food scraps and use this as kind of a micro business for these farms. If they have that as an input for feeding their livestock, as well as a supplementary income, it means that they do not necessarily have to produce food in order to sell it to sustain their farms. We're really trying to figure out ways that we can reduce the cost of producing food for the community, because this is something that everyone needs, and it really shouldn't be the way that farms have to sustain themselves. There's just not a lot of money that you can make from a head of cabbage, but we know that there are other ways that we can create supplementary income streams that allow us to help these budding businesses really flourish instead of really having to rely on very variable weather patterns and planting seasons and hoping everything works out for their CSAs. So it's been an awesome initiative. We had 150 buckets donated from Home Depot so that we could launch this program and get these buckets into as many hands as possible. We are doing the first 2 weeks of pickups totally free. And then it's just a subscription, and that goes on a monthly basis. And this also allows us to give free shipping on any of the products that are locally produced, whether those are artisans or CSA shares, many little products that we have a bunch of amazing people producing in this community. And we want to be able to offer free shipping, so anyone who signs up for compost can then get free shipping on all of these locally made products.
What do people need to do in order to sign in for compost? Is it online, or do they need to call you?
Yeah, so composting is super easy to sign up for. You can visit our website at yellowbarn.farm/compost.
Since we have been celebrating the month of the earth, we have been listening to so many environmental activists telling us that this is the moment. If we don't wake up now, when?
I think everyone's really hearing the call, especially this last year with COVID, of everyone really having to be completely by yourself and isolated and feeling very much cut off from each other and the earth around us. I can say personally for me, I had been living in Boston for the last 5 years, really in this city, and had just really been feeling the call to come home to this land, to contribute in any way I can to really regenerate this beautiful property. And we're really trying to make this into a community accessible establishment where we're all out here. Everyone's really volunteering and putting their hands back in the earth and really contributing. And it's such a simple way for all of us to get involved to actually fight climate change, which feels like such an overwhelming task. And most people don't really know where to start. The easiest place to start is to come plant a tree, and you can do that very, very easily. You can visit us at yellowbarn.farm if you'd like to adopt a tree and support us that way, or if you'd like to physically come to the property, definitely feel free to contact us through our website. We would love to meet you.
Thank you so much. For KGNU, I am Rosanna Longo.
That was Azaree Wyckoff, Executive Director of the Yellow Barn Farm. If you're looking to get your hands in the dirt and plant a tree, there are still opportunities to do so today, Thursday the 29th, and tomorrow, Friday the 30th, from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. More information, go to yellowbarn.farm. To learn more about the Regenerative Design Research Land Stewardship, you can go to drylandsagroecologyresearch.org.